So tonight, I'm going to be talking about rebellion. Rebellion, and what is the price of rebellion? Is there a price to rebellion? And we read here in 1 Samuel 15, if we back up a couple verses, of course, I think we're all familiar with this passage. It's a very well-known passage we go to quite often because it illustrates some very simple points, very explicitly. It's very easy to do a lesson out of this because you just kind of have to read the verses and there you have it. So I'm not going to go into too much detail because I don't think there's anything that isn't made obvious by the verses. But Samuel said, is it not true, verse 17, is it not true, though you were little in your own eyes, you were made the head of the tribes of Israel, and the Lord anointed you king over Israel. There was a time when you thought, this position of being king is too much for me. What's he say? Am I not from a small family? Am I not from a small tribe? Is not this too big of a position for me? This isn't fitting. I'm too small for this. Verse 18, and the Lord sent you on a mission and said, go and utterly destroy the sinners, the Amalekites, and fight against them until they are exterminated. Why then did you not obey the voice of the Lord, but rushed upon the spoil and did what was evil in the sight of the Lord? Then Saul said to Samuel, I did obey the voice of the Lord, and went on a mission on which the Lord sent me, and have brought back Agag, the king of Amalek, and have utterly destroyed the Amalekites. But the people took some of the spoil, sheep and oxen, the choicest of the things devoted to destruction, to sacrifice to the Lord your God at Gilgal. So we all remember when Saul makes this excuse, and it is an excuse. And Samuel says, if that's true, if what you're saying is true, why do I hear the bleating of sheep in the background? Why do I hear so much livestock in the background? Why is there so much noise? This isn't a graveyard. This is a farm. Why is that? How do you have the temerity to lie to my face? Have you noticed how bold some people are with their lies? You know, especially these days, they will lie right to your face on national television. And you can say, well, I can fact check that right here. Doesn't matter. That's what we're saying. That's the narrative. That's what we're going with. And if you don't believe it, you're a conspiracy theorist or whatever. But we're going to lie to you until you eventually believe us. Or when you find us out, we're just going to move on. Okay? Some people have the temerity to lie and have no shame about it. Saul at least has an excuse. He says, well, I wanted to do it, but the people, and who could deny the people? You know, there's a lot more of them than there are of me. And what was I going to do? I'm just one man. But the people, verse 21, took some of the spoil, sheep and oxen, and choicest of the things devoted to destruction. And by the way, Samuel, I don't know if you thought of this, but they had the idea to devote it to the Lord your God at Gilgal. Now, some people will make a big deal out of them saying, your God. That's not a big deal. That happens all throughout the Old Testament. Prophets say that. Righteous people say that. Unrighteous people say that. It's just the way they talked. Okay? It's the Lord, your God. There's some very righteous people that said the exact same thing. They weren't saying, he's not my God, he's your God. He's making the point that these sacrifices are going to your God, my God too, but your God as well. Shouldn't you be happy about that? Samuel said, has the Lord as much delight in burnt offerings and sacrifices as in obeying the voice of the Lord? A good question. Wouldn't it be better just to do what he says? Instead of openly rebelling and then saying, well, I did openly rebel, but here's a little knickknack for you. No, it would be much better just to obey. Verse 22, has the Lord as much delight in burnt offerings and sacrifices as in obeying the voice of the Lord? Behold, to obey is better than sacrifice, and to heed than the fat of rams. What happens when you don't obey somebody? What happens when you hear commands and you say, eh, not for me? No, thank you. Is that a respectful relationship? Is that a trustworthy relationship? Is that a relationship, you know, you've got that sheep and you tell him to go over here and he just goes over there. He always zigs when he should zag. Is that going to end well for that sheep? No, that's not going to end well. Look at this, verse 23. For rebellion is as the sin of divination. Now, why is it compared to divination? Well, probably because Saul went on a crusade to rid the land of divination. That was his pet sin. We can have no divination. Now, rebellion, I'm fine with that. But divination, absolutely not. And, you know, we can have that same kind of... we can get lost in one sin as well. I'm going to talk all about homosexuality. Now, all this other stuff, yeah, whatever. But that sin I'm really focused on. Well, we need to be focused on all of them, okay? Not just one. Not, I got rid of this one, now I can do whatever I want. No, it's the whole plethora. It's the whole panoply. Okay, verse 23, for rebellion is as the sin of divination and insubordination. Now look at that word, insubordination. What does that tell you? There is a pecking order. God is up here, you are down here. When you rebel, when you disobey, what is that saying? I'm not taking orders from you. I'm going to go do my own thing. That is insubordination. No army can work like that. Now there are, you know, there are some very successful businesses that tend to work like that because they have specialties. But when you're talking about God in particular, when he tells you something, you can rest assured that it is correct, okay? That it is correct, and you cannot be insubordinate to it. And insubordination is as iniquity and idolatry because you have rejected the word of the Lord. What is the consequence? He has also rejected you from being king. There's a consequence to rebellion. If you rebel, you might say, well, you know, that's not the worst thing in the world. So I say, I'm not going to do this set of things, or I will do this set of things. It could be a lot worse. It could be a lot worse. I could be like a witch out there. I could be doing witchcraft or something like that. That would be a lot worse. You could go back and forth on that and argue that, but the end point is that rebellion has consequences. That is to say, consequence with sequence. You do one thing, to put it in physics terms, every action has an equal and opposite reaction. You do one thing, it's going to lead to another. It has a sequel, a sequela. It has something that is going to happen as a direct consequence of you doing that. And if you rebel against God, you're not going to like the consequences. The consequences are dire. They're fatal. They are eternally fatal. Now, you might ask, is rebellion ever good? Think about that for a second. Is rebellion ever good? Well, I mean, we have to say that at times rebellion is good. King Nebuchadnezzar told the people to do what when they heard the sound of music? You bow down and you worship that God. And you say, well, I can't rebel. I got to do what he says. No, rebellion in that case was good. And it depends how, you know, it depends what side you're on, whether you call it rebellion. For example, the people of Jericho would have called Rahab a no good, dirty, lying turncoat, a traitor. But the Israelite says, man, what a patriot. What a faithful follower of God. And so too we do with our wars. You know, if somebody turns on the British, we call them a patriot. If they call them a traitor, and the other way, we call them a traitor, they call them a patriot. But the point I want to make is sometimes rebellion in this world is appropriate. They told the Christians, renounce Christ Or you're going to get fed to the lions. What did they do? They said, well, we can't rebel against the powers. We just got to do it. I got to renounce him. I'm sorry. Can't rebel. No, I'm going to rebel. In a way, we rebel against Satan. Satan has power, dominion over this world. We all walked according to the lust of our flesh. But what's the New Testament tell us? Resist the devil. Rebel against the devil, and he will flee from you. We need to rebel, but we can't rebel against God. Rebelling against God, you're always going to be in the wrong. Any other rebellion, you have a chance of being in the wrong. But rebelling against God, you will 100% of the time be wrong. Now, there are other times, to go down this rabbit hole, when people will say you're rebelling against God, but you're really rebelling against their religion, their system. The Pharisees, if you didn't do all of their commandments that were designed by men, they would say, you're rebelling against God. You didn't wash. You didn't do all of these things that we've added. Okay, that's not rebelling against God. That's rebelling against your rules, some rules that may be good, some rules that may have sense, but it's not rebelling against God. And so too with many religions, they will emphasize a set of things. In fact, the Catholics would say, if we don't do X, Y, and Z, we're rebelling against God. If we don't venerate Mary, we're rebelling against God because God wants us to venerate Mary. We had to say no. No, we're rebelling against the Catholic Church. We're not rebelling against God. Okay, but to truly rebel against God is always fatal. You cannot pick God as your opponent and expect to win. That's just nonsensical. It doesn't make any sense. And it reminds me of the judges. You remember what was the refrain in the judges? Every man did that which was right in his own sight. And what's that going to lead to? It's going to lead to chaos. There was no God in Israel at that time. Now, was there a God in Israel? Was there supposed to be? Or a king in Israel, sorry? A king in Israel? Well, of course. In fact, in 1 Samuel, when they ask for a king, God says, they've rejected me, not you. I was the king. But no one recognized me as king. And they rebelled. And they kept getting worse and worse. That's the natural consequence. Because you start off on the right spot, you rebel, you go off, you veer off, and then you start off on that spot. You veer off some more, then you start off on that spot. You veer off some more, and so on and so on. That's just the natural way of things. Okay, let's turn over to Romans chapter 1. You say, well, I can't rebel against God. Somebody says, I can't rebel against God because I don't even believe in God. I don't even believe in God. And I haven't been given the sufficient amount of evidence to meet my my rather high standards of evidence. So therefore, I cannot rebel. I plead ignorance. You can't hold me accountable. Okay. Let's read Romans chapter 1, starting in verse 14. Of course, Paul speaking here. I'm under obligation both to Greeks and to barbarians, both to the wise and to the foolish. So for my part, I am eager to preach the gospel to you also who are in Rome, for I am not ashamed of the gospel, for it is the power of God for salvation to everyone who believes, to the Jew first and also to the Greek. For it is the righteousness of God is revealed from faith to faith, as it is written, but the righteous man shall live by faith. For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who suppress the truth in unrighteousness. We're going to notice a theme that rebelling sees something, it has something, but it rejects it. It suppresses it. It sees the truth. It sees the light, but it rejects the light. It says, no, I don't want that. And here, Paul makes the point that he's sent to both the Jews and the Greeks. There's no racism here. There's no special treatment of one over the other. And he says, what makes someone just is not whether they're a Greek or Jew, but whether they live by faith or they don't. And what makes the wrath of God appear on them is not whether they are a Greek or Jew, but it's based on what? Verse 18, for the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness, whether you're Greek or Jew, and unrighteousness of men who do what? Who suppress the truth and unrighteousness. Now, to suppress the truth, you have to have the truth. Okay? To suppress the truth, you have to have the truth. Because, verse 19, because that which is known about God is evident within them. I don't believe because I don't have enough evidence. Oh, really? Is that true? For God made it evident to them. Now, how did he do that? Verse 20, for since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes, his eternal power and divine nature have been clearly seen, being understood through what has been made, so that they are without excuse. I have an excuse. I'm ignorant. I plead ignorance. No, you can't plead ignorance. Why is that? Because Psalm 19, the heavens declare the glory of God. Night unto night, they sing his praises. There's no spot on the earth where the song is not heard. There's no person that can say, I didn't know. No, impossible. For since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes, his eternal power and divine nature have been clearly, notice that word, clearly seen, being understood through what has been made. So what's he saying, basically? We see this creation. We see how things work in this creation. We see the glory of this creation, the intelligence needed to make a creation like this. We see how these systems work together. We see how men and women come together to give life to a new person. We see all the systems that are needed for such things, the systems for agriculture, the systems for weather, all these things working together perfectly. And we can't but help to say, someone made this. And you know, what do they do? Are you aware NASA is looking for extraterrestrial life? Are you aware of that? SETI, it's called. The search for extraterrestrial intelligence, I believe. They're looking for that. How are they looking for that? You know what they're doing? They're looking for just simple patterns. I just need a little pattern, and that pattern's going to tell me what? That there's intelligence somewhere. I see a little pattern, it tells me there's intelligence. That is a message. Just as if I were on the beach and I saw SOS, I would say, that's probably not coincidence. That probably came from a mind. You know, the great philosopher Bill Clinton said, if you see a turtle on a fence post, you know it didn't get there by itself. It's just obvious. It came from a mind. There's no information without intelligence. Yeah, we see all the information in this world and we say, it just happened. The DNA, a little more complicated than an SOS. Where did it come from? Well, it only makes sense that it came from a mind. And from the complexity that we see his eternal power, his divine nature. This isn't from a human mind. This isn't from some feeble mind. This is from something that we can't even understand, that we can't fully comprehend. Being understood through that which was made. So we see the painting, and it's a gorgeous painting, and we say, I don't know who made this, but somebody extremely talented made this. You know, I can't tell you all the details. I can't tell you his name. I can't tell you X, Y, or Z. But somebody extremely talented made this. It didn't just happen. Okay? Professing to be wise, they became fools. I want to throw off the shackles. I know there's a God, but I'm going to say the quiet part out loud. I don't want there to be a God.
So I'm going to throw off the shackles, I'm going to dispose of it, and I'm going to pretend as if he does not exist. And exchange the glory of the incorruptible, the Creator, for what? And exchange the glory of the incorruptible God for an image in the form of corruptible man and of birds and of four-footed animals and crawling creatures. Therefore, God gave them over in the lust of their hearts to impurity. Are there consequences to rebellion? Yes, absolutely. It always is going to have consequences. There are going to be penalties for rebelling against the Almighty. There's no way around it. And it goes on to talk about all the consequences. I think we're rather familiar with those. So we're going to turn over to Psalm 2. Psalm 2. I was thinking about this in light of this message. And I never thought about it this way. But it's really the same idea. Psalm 2, of course, a messianic psalm talking about Jesus, and it's applied in Acts 4 to the messianic age, and it's one of the groups in the beginning that is plotting against God and against His anointed is actually the Jews, which would be a surprise to the Jews who read this all the time, but that's what it is. Why are the nations in an uproar? And the peoples devising a vain thing, the kings of the earth take their stand, and the rulers take counsel together against the Lord and against His anointed, saying, let us tear their fetters apart and cast away the cords from us. So what do they know? They know that there is a God, Romans 1. They know that He has dominion over them. But what do they say? At least they're honest. They say, we want to do away with Him. Crucify Him. We want nothing to do with Him. So how can we plot to take the fetters apart? So he's got us bound up. He's got us bound up. And how so? What would their idea be? Thou shalt and thou shalt not. You got to do this and you can't do that. We don't like that. Let's throw those fetters off. Let's break out of the prison. Let's do whatever we want. And cast away the cords from us. Of course, what is God's response to this? So they say, it's rebellion. It's rebellion. What does God say? He who sits in the heavens laughs. The Lord scoffs at them. Is that any threat? Does that pose any threat? They did this. And they could say, well, we did crucify Jesus. Okay, well, how'd that work out for you? That was part of the plan. Then He will speak to them in His anger and terrify them in His fury, saying, but as for me, I've installed my king upon Zion, my holy mountain. I will surely tell of the decree of the Lord. He said to me, you are my son. Today I've begotten you. Ask of me, and I will surely give the nations as your inheritance, and the very ends of the earth as your possession. These are all mine. I give them to whom I please. They cannot defeat you. Just ask, and they're yours. You shall break them with the rod of iron. You shall shatter them like earthenware. These nations, these kings that have come together, probably think quite highly of themselves, professing themselves to be wise. They became fools. But know this, they're just jars of clay, and you can shatter them at your desire. Now therefore, O kings, let me give you some advice. Show discernment, take warning, O judges of the earth, worship the Lord with reverence, and rejoice with trembling. Don't rebel, rather worship. Don't turn away from God, turn to God. Don't say, I'm going to take the shackles off, say, I'm going to be His servant, okay? Do homage to the Son, that He will not become angry and you perish in the way, for His wrath may soon be kindled. But how blessed are all those who take refuge in Him. You do not want to pick God as your enemy. If you pick God as your enemy, you are going to suffer the consequences. And what are those? Those are eternal defeat.
eternal condemnation. Rather, you take refuge in him. You go to him for protection. We talked about this morning, the good shepherd who guards his sheep. The sheep come to him, they look to him for protection. They don't rebel against him and give themselves to the lions and the wolves. Okay, only two more things. Let's turn over to John 3. John 3. So, in both situations, there are people that know. They've received something, and they say, that's not for me. I don't want that. I'm rebelling. God says this, I say, absolutely not. And we find the same thing in John chapter 3, starting in verse 16. For God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that whoever believes in him shall not perish but have eternal life. For God did not send his Son unto the world to judge the world, but that the world might be saved through him. He who believes in him is not judged. He who does not believe has been judged already, because he has not believed in the name of the only begotten Son of God. And what is the judgment? He's been judged already. What is the judgment? Verse 19. This is the judgment, that the light has come into the world. Now, who's the light? Jesus is the true light, John chapter 1. John is not the light, but Jesus is the true light who comes into the world and lights every man. This is the judgment, that the light has come into the world, and men love the darkness rather than the light, for their deeds were evil. Therefore, what are we going to do? We're going to rebel. We're going to rebel. For everyone who does evil hates the light and does not come to the light for fear that his deeds will be exposed. But he who practices the truth comes to the light so that his deeds may be manifested as having been wrought in God. We don't like the light. We love our sin more than we love the light. Therefore, we are not going to conform. We are not going to obey. We are not going to genuflex. We're not going to bend the knee. We're going to rebel. That's the path we choose. Will there be consequences? Absolutely. The consequences will be dire. Let's see what those consequences are in the parable. This will be the last thing we look at. Matthew 21. Matthew 21 will end with this. Matthew 21, a parable of Jesus. Starting in verse 33, the parable of the landowner. Verse 33 of Matthew 21, listen to another parable. There was a landowner who planted a vineyard and put a wall around it and dug a wine press in it and built a tower and rented it out to vine growers and went on a journey. When the harvest time approached, he sent his slaves to the vine growers to receive his produce. The vine growers took his slaves and beat one and killed another and stoned a third. Again, he sent another group of slaves larger than the first, and they did the same thing to them. But afterward, he sent his son to them, saying, "They will respect my son." But when the vine growers saw the son, they said amongst themselves, "This is the heir. Come, let us kill him and seize his inheritance." They took him and threw him out of the vineyard and killed him. Does that sound familiar? Where was Jesus killed? Outside of Jerusalem. Therefore, when the owner of the vineyard comes, what will he do to those vine growers? And that's the question, isn't it? So vine growers that are on the payroll of this owner, and how do they treat his servants? They killed him. What's that alluding to? Well, obviously, well, maybe not obviously, but if you've studied this parable, it's talking about Israel as the vineyard, like we see in Isaiah 5. Israel's in many other places. Isaiah 5, Israel is that vineyard. And what did God send to them over and over again? Prophets. And what did they do to those prophets?
They killed them. They killed them. They mistreated them first. They rejected them. They said, no, that's not right. And then they killed them. Okay? And what's God say? What's the owner say? Well, I know. I'll send my son. They won't dare kill my son, will they? Well, they sure did. But the thing I want us to notice, did they know it was someone special? Now, they didn't know it was actually God himself. How could they? But they did know, they should have known, that he was from God. Why? Because of the miracles, because of the signs, because of the evidence. Now, I don't know how you can know it was actually God himself, how that would even be possible unless he said it and you believed it. But certainly this man is from God. As we see over and over throughout the book of John, we know you're from God. And Jesus tells his disciples, believe in me. If you don't believe because of the words, believe because of the signs I've done. Okay? So there is evidence. And they say, what do they say? Yeah, this is somebody special. If we kill him, what is ours? The inheritance. So this one is sent from God, of course. What's Nicodemus say? Of course we know you're sent from God. No one can do these signs unless they're from God. Of course we know that. The man born blind, what's he say? I don't know much, but I know you're from God because no one's ever heard of someone restoring the sight of someone. You have to be from God. It's obvious. You've made it obvious, Romans chapter 1. You've made it obvious. It's clear. They said to him, or in verse 40, therefore, when the owner of the vineyard comes, what will he do to those vine growers? And they said to him, he will bring those wretches to a wretched end and will rent out the vineyard to other vine growers who will pay him the proceeds at the proper season. That's exactly right. Does rebellion have consequences? Absolutely. Were there consequences for those that rejected Jesus? Absolutely. Were there consequences for Jerusalem in particular? Absolutely. Look at AD 70. That was not a pleasant time. It was a horrible time. They are consequences for rebellion. Now, the good news is that those who accepted Jesus later could have forgiveness. Isn't it interesting that it says, here's the son in verse 38. But when the vine growers saw the son, they said amongst themselves, this is the heir. Come, let us kill him and seize his inheritance. Isn't it interesting that what does Jesus offer us? Well, exactly that, an inheritance. John chapter 1. Those that he came to did not receive him, but those who did receive him, he gave them the privilege, the right to become children of God. They were born not of blood, not of the will of man, but of God. They became inheritors of God because they joined the family of God. But these people say, I don't want to do it like that. I'm going to rebel. I want to keep all the things that we have just as they are. And that would be a fight that would be fought throughout the New Testament, the Judaizing teachers. We want to keep everything exactly like it is, and we want to have our cake and eat it too. We want all the nice things you say, but we don't want any of the things that are not quite to our fancy. So we're going to rebel against some of it, but have all the good things. Is that going to work? Absolutely not. You either submit in everything or you're a rebel. You can't say, well, I pick this over here and I pick that over there. No, you submit to everything or you are a rebel. Okay, they said to him, he will bring those wretches to a wretched end and he will rent out the vineyard to other vine growers who will pay the proceeds at the proper season. Jesus said to them, did you never read in the scriptures, the stone which the builders rejected, this became the chief cornerstone. Notice that again. We won't go too far into this. But the stone the builders rejected, they see something, and what did they do? They reject. They rebel. I don't want that stone. Of course, the irony is they're supposed to be the most knowledgeable. They're supposed to be the ones that know the most about this. And they see this perfect cornerstone and they say, "Nah, that's no good. That's not good quality." This became the chief cornerstone. This came about from the Lord, and it is marvelous in our eyes. Therefore, I say to you, the kingdom of God will be taken away from you and given to a people producing the fruit of it. And he who falls on this stone will be broken to pieces, but on whomever it falls, it will scatter him like dust. The consequences of rebelling against God are ultimate defeat. There's no possibility of success. There is nothing you can do to augment your possibilities of success. If you go against God, you are going to suffer a humiliating defeat, and there's nothing you can do except humbly repent and come to him. When the chief priests and the Pharisees heard his parable, they understood that he was speaking about them. When they sought to seize him, they feared the people because they considered him to be a prophet. And of course, the people were right. But to end, rebellion. As I said, in some situations, it can't even be a good thing. It can be a necessary thing. You can't be a Christian anymore. You can't confess the name of Christ. That may come. It's already, it's been around for a long time in many nations. You can't confess Christ in North Korea, for example. Other communist countries, you can't do it. Well, you say, well, they have a past there. They just can't rebel against their leaders. That would be wrong. No, they need to rebel. They need to rebel. But rebelling against God is a wholly different thing. And in fact, even, we're to respect our parents. But if your parents say, you can't become a Christian, we're Hindus, you can't become a Christian, you say, I'm going to rebel. I'm going to rebel. And what's Jesus say? He who loves father and mother more than me is not worthy of me. Sometimes rebellion is appropriate, is good. But rebelling against God will always end in a hopeless, humiliating defeat. And there's nothing you can do to change that. That is an assured defeat. The good news, if you follow God, if you come to God, that is an assured victory. If you are a servant of God, as much as the defeat of the enemies of God is sure, your victory will be sure. Why is that? Because you've aligned yourself, you've humbly aligned yourself with he who has already conquered death, he who is the creator of all, and you have victory in Jesus forever. If anyone has any needs, we'd ask that you come.